Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Through a Craft, Energy, and most recently Protecting the Wild. Today we talk about what a healthy forest means. We hear that phrase all the time, but what does it mean? And we talk about the role of dead trees in a healthy forest. We've talked about that a little bit before, but I think we can't talk enough about the role of dead trees in a healthy forest. So first, thank you for all your great work over the decades, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Sure, appreciate being here too. Thank you.
So let's start with that first question. What do you mean when you say a healthy forest? And also, what does the timber industry, national forests, etc., what do they mean when they say healthy forest?
That's an excellent question, and the contrast between the two is where there's a lot of conflict and misinformation from my perspective. The start with the Forest Service and the timber industry first. They have what I would call an industrial forest bias. In other words, if you're going to produce trees as a timber product for lumber or other uses, your goal is to maximize the growth of the trees as rapidly as possible and to protect the trees from anything that might reduce the growth or kill the trees. And so, with that in mind, the Forest Service and other forestry schools, etc., teach you that a healthy forest is one that has primarily a lot of green trees that are growing at maximum or pretty close to maximum growth rates. And to facilitate that kind of industrial paradigm, the industry and Forest Service and others do things like, see as a problem, for example, when trees are dense on a hillside, that density, of course, reduces the growth of individual trees, and that's seen as a disadvantage from the industrial paradigm. But that could be seen as a good thing from the point of view of a forest ecosystem, and I'll just use this as one example. When trees grow under dense conditions, they have denser wood. And when those trees die from whatever causes it might be, that's the source of mortality, the denser wood takes a longer time to rot. And hopefully in a minute we'll talk about why dead trees are important to the ecosystem, but the longevity of that dead wood is increased growing under dense conditions. So from the industrial paradigm, dense conditions are bad, but from a forest ecosystem perspective, it may be a good. So to give the other side of it, what is a healthy forest ecosystem? A healthy forest ecosystem is dominated by many ecological processes that help to keep the diversity of the forest and the resilience of the forest intact. And a lot of the things that the industrial paradigm sees as negative are actually things that increase the resilience of the forest. And then here's the funny thing. The industrial paradigm suggests that they want to increase the resilience of the forest by logging it. For example, again, using the density factor, they would say that reducing the density of the trees through thinning means that there's more water or light or whatever for the trees that are left, which means that they will be in a position to resist certain pathogens like disease or bark beetles and other things that cause mortality. And from the industrial paradigm, again, because keeping trees living is what they try to do, that is a good thing. But from the forest ecosystem point of view, dead trees are a real benefit. So shall I talk a little bit about why dead trees are important?
Yeah, I was hoping you would, except there's one thing you said in here first, and please correct my misspeaking of this, but you said something about various processes. Oh, I shouldn't have said anything because I can't remember exactly what you said. I'm sorry.
Well,
You were talking about
the
various
pro
processes that can be considered harmful from the perspective of the timber industry. Can you give some tangible examples? You said overcrowding. One that comes to mind immediately for me is Green Diamond around here, the timber company, routinely shoots bears because bears will sometimes girdle trees. And when they girdle a tree, they're pulling the bark off and eating it, and that kills trees. And so that from the perspective of, and by the way, I want to say one more thing, which is that the timber industry actually does not want for trees to live. They want for trees to live long enough for them to cut them down. But in any case, can you talk about a few of the other processes that people might not think about that the timber industry would oppose, natural processes, but are good for a forest?
Sure. Well, there are a lot of ones that are pretty common. Drought, for example, will kill trees. Wildfires will kill trees. Bark beetles will kill trees. Mistletoe, which is a parasitic plant, will help to kill trees. Those are examples of sources of mortality that the timber industry tends to look upon unfavorably. Yet all of those sources of mortality are very important to healthy forest ecosystems. And this is a very important point. The way a tree dies, the source of mortality affects the future trajectory in the forest ecosystem. For example, bark beetles, by burrowing into the tree and exposing the inner part of the tree to access to it, to other things like fungi, cause those trees to rot in a different way than, say, a tree that's killed by wildfire. A charred fire surface, the black char, is very resistant to rot. So, in a forest ecosystem, if the tree is killed by a wildfire, it has a different future trajectory in how it rots compared to one that's killed by, say, bark beetles. And each of those, in turn, has long-term effects. For example, the bark beetle kill tree, with the access provided by fungi, makes those trees easier to excavate, so become more important for cavity nesting birds than a tree that's killed by wildfire, which is more difficult to excavate and put in a cavity. So those are the kinds of changes that, depending on the kind of mortality, affects how the forest ecosystem is for all sorts of other animals and plants that may depend on those dead trees. And the dead trees, there's some ecologists will say that dead trees are more important to a healthy forest ecosystem than live trees. And there's several reasons for that. It might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but to counter the current thinking that green forests are what's a healthy forest, it's probably not bad to say that. And dead trees are that, for one thing, they tend to last longer in the ecosystem than live trees. It takes hundreds of years for a tree killed, particularly by wildfire, to fully rot and molder back into the soil. So it may be contributing to the forest ecosystem over the long term for a longer period of time than a live tree. And at each stage of how it rots, from when it's a standing snag to when it falls down to when it rots out more, so it's kind of pulpy, to where it's sort of just sort of fibers in the soil. At each stage of that whole rotting and decay process, there's different animals and species that find a home or food there. So, for example, when it's a snag, we're real familiar with things like woodpeckers living in snags. Lots of other animals rely on snags. Everything from bats that are sometimes live in the cavities inside dead trees or under the flaky bark that hasn't fallen off, to, if it's a big enough tree with a cavity, you might have a black bear denning inside. You definitely get other smaller mammals like marten, and fisher living inside those dead snags and in cavities and flying squirrels. And then when it falls to the ground, it becomes habitat for things like insects. A lot of the bees that are found in our forest ecosystem, and there are literally thousands of native bees, but a lot of them live in dead trees on the ground and in the pulpy kind of wood that's in the soil. And they are major pollinators in our forest ecosystems, as well as in, you know, domestic orchards and so forth, too. And so having that dead wood on the ground is important to them. And then, of course, lots of small mammals might be living under the tree. Amphibians like frogs and salamanders live under dead trees on the ground. And it's not just in the forest floor. When the dead trees fall into a stream, for example, they provide structure to the stream. So you have, it slows the current down, it protects the banks, and insects live on the dead trees and eat the dead trees, the litter from the dead trees, and that provides food for all sorts of fish and other animals up through the food chain. So even falling in a stream, dead wood is important there. And then there is the carbon storage factor, especially in global warming times. Now, as a tree rots, it does give off carbon into the atmosphere. However, it takes many, again, sometimes hundreds of years for that tree to fully decay and release a lot of that carbon. And right now, given the rising CO2 levels on the Earth, we need to reduce carbon losses to the atmosphere right now, not trying to have them be sequestered 200 years from now. People argue that we should be thinning forests so that we can have young trees growing, which do sequester carbon. But the existing live as well as dead trees store a lot of carbon, and leaving that in the forest ecosystem provides long-term storage for carbon, especially wildfire trees killed by wildfire. They can have charred surfaces, and charcoal and charred surfaces reduces decay and slows it down. And also that charcoal, when it gets into the soil, it's very stable, stays there for sometimes thousands of years. So, what we find is that the carbon storage of dead trees is a significant factor. And there are other things for wildlife, for example. There's some studies, they vary in the percentages, but some estimate between 45 and 50% of all bird species depend on dead trees sometime in their life. And that may be, you know, as I mentioned before, a cavity to live in. It might be where they feed on it. It might be where they roost. Spotted owls, for example, will hunt in areas that have dead trees because their main food, which is squirrels and voles, tend to like to live under dead trees. So having a lot of dead trees on the forest floor is good for, say, spotted owls. The other animals out there, from mammals all the way down into the insects, snakes, amphibians I mentioned, and so forth, all depend on dead wood in various ways. So from a wildlife perspective, dead wood is an important component in the forest ecosystem, and it also is a long-term nutrient storage, and especially in the wetter forests of the West Coast, often go in the forest and see where other trees are growing on top of a down log that's called a nurse log, and it facilitates the growth of the next generation of trees that get their nutrients from that down log and incorporate it in the new growth. So it's just a sort of the height of ignorance to suggest that dead trees and the things that cause dead trees, like drought, like wildfires, like bark beetles, etc., are bad for forest ecosystems. It's exactly what creates a healthy, resilient forest ecosystem. And by contrast, logging short circuits all those factors. It reduces the mortality from these natural processes, and it removes the biomass and the carbon from the forest ecosystem, and it has other factors associated with it that have nothing to do with, you know, the removal of the trees, but things like the sedimentation from logging roads affecting spawning streams of salmon, or the introduction of weeds along roads and so forth. All of those things are harmful to the forest ecosystem in the long term. So what we have is this activity, logging activity, that's being done in the name of forest restoration and resilience is in fact impoverishing forest ecosystems.
You know, one of the lines I keep thinking about as you talk is something by John Livingston, where he said that there is no surplus in nature. And I didn't really understand what that when I first read it decades ago, but it didn't take very long for me to realize that everything is somebody's food. And if you take a tree out of a forest, then that is a tree that can no longer be used by the bats. So everything in a forest or in a river or in the ocean or wherever, in a desert, doesn't matter, a grassland, will end up food for someone.
Exactly. And in fact, you mentioned something that I hadn't thought of or hadn't mentioned in this talk so far, is especially in the coastal rivers, that wood gets carried out to sea and becomes important to our marine ecosystems. A lot of the estuaries along the coast have down logs and wood in it, and everything from, you know, mussels and clams to crabs and sea marine worms, etc., depend on that wood for their home. So it even is important in marine ecosystems to deal with.
So another line I'm thinking about is decades ago now, I was talking to Dick Manning after his book on forestry in Montana. I don't remember the name of it right now. Final Cut, maybe. Anyway, one of the things that he said when he was talking to me is that every time he goes into an ancient forest, he is humbled, and it reminds him of mortality because there is so much death in the forest. And he's talking about just seeing dead trees. And so this is sort of a way to ask you the question. I know this is going to be different for different sorts of forests, but if you have any even just made up numbers, so in an old growth redwood forest or old growth Doug fir forest, ponderosa pine forest, whatever, just rough, make up the numbers, what percentage of the trees might be dead at any time, do you think?
I really don't know, but I will say that the you'll find more dead wood on the more productive forests. So, you know, redwoods in particular, because they're resistant to rotting, so it piles up. But, you know, the coastal forests have a lot of biomass on the forest floor, and then, of course, as you get to drier ecosystems, there's less and less just growth in general, so you have less biomass there. But, you know, you just made me think of a thought, and that is when we're doing the logging, the industrial paradigm, or the thinning, as the Forest Service says, for resilience, what we're doing is sanitizing the forest floor. I go into, and I've visited 7 or 8 of these supposedly sustainable forestry projects around the West, and what I always see is that there's a lack of dead wood in those supposedly sustainable forestry operation, you know, and now they may leave a few snags here and there and that kind of thing, but it doesn't compare anywhere near to the amount of dead wood and wood you'd see on the forest floor in a natural state. And I have to think that in the long haul, those are not sustainable operations in terms of a forest ecosystem point of view. Most sustainable forestry that's certified is about sustaining a supply of timber to the mill, and even supply of timber. And it has not really a lot to do with the sustainable ecosystem, per se. And so, I question that. In fact, if, you know, one of the conundrums that we have as a society is I tend to believe, and this is just an opinion, I can't prove it, but that any level of commercial timber production extraction is probably beyond what is sustainable in the long run for the ecosystem of the forest. And that's probably contrary to what we say. And I can't say, how many trees can you take out of a stand and not have a significant impact? There's probably some level of removal that you can do that isn't going to be, that significant. But certainly at the level that's commercially viable, in other words, where you can make a profit at it, I think you have to take too many trees and too much wood out of the ecosystem to call it sustainable.
I think that if we turn the question around, we could say, so how much skin could be removed from your body before you die? How much skin could be removed sustainably? Because once again, I'm not saying that no one should ever in their lives cut a tree. I'm not saying that if you remove one tree from a forest, it's going to collapse. Of course, neither one of us is saying that. What we're saying is that if you remove even one tree from a forest, you are removing that food and that home from someone else. And whether that one tree causes the entire forest to unravel, probably not. But the point is that every tree you take out is one tree that can't be used by pileated woodpeckers.
And it's, or ants, for example. I didn't mention this before, but it's a pretty, I've been reading a lot about ants to the degree that I can even find anything about them, but in forest ecosystems. But ants are the most common invertebrate in forest ecosystems, and they're real important for, cycling nutrients. You see how they hollow out trees and they make tunnels into the soil that aerates the soil and so forth. So, the importance of those dead trees to the ants is basically ignored by the industrial forest paradigm. And yet those ants have other lines in the ecosystem that they sustain. For example, I remember about 5 summers ago, I was walking through Yellowstone Park in the Lodgepole Pine Forest that looked like it burned, maybe 60 years before, and judging by the size of the trees that had grown back. And all over the ground was a lot of logs that had fallen over since the previous fire. And almost all the logs along the trail that I was walking were torn up by a grizzly bear looking for ants. In fact, in the summertime, and this is surprising to a lot of people, in the summertime, ants are one of the major food suppliers for both black bears and grizzly bears, and especially if it's a bad berry year. So who would think that a forest fire 60 years before that killed most of the trees, which later fall to the ground and therefore become homes to ants, later sustains grizzly bears? Is the Fish and Wildlife Service thinking about ants and dead trees when they talk about delisting grizzly bears, and protecting that food source? No, they let the Forest Service go in and thin forests and try to stop fires and suppress fires, and in the effect of doing that, they're destroying future grizzly bear food.
So a couple things. One of them is that one of the things I really enjoy about speaking with you is that both of us seem to understand the line that is so important, that David Ehrenfeld said about how nature is not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we can think. If I was designing a forest just off the top of my head, I don't know that it would occur to me to make it so you have slow decaying logs eaten by ants and eaten by grizzly bears. It's the interwoven complexity continues to delight and stun me.
Exactly. And it's to me, that's the whole thing I love about ecology. The more I learn about it, the more fascinating and wonderful it all seems, it's a constant new way of viewing things, and that is what is so exciting about learning about these things, both, you know, reading other people's research as well as just, you know, my own observations when I'm out in the woods and thinking about what I'm seeing, like the grizzly bear tearing up the ants and thinking about the fire before that made the habitat for the ants food for the grizzly bears.
So I have no idea if you have an answer to this question, but the land where I live was cut maybe 50 years ago, and it's coming back well. It's redwood forest, and part of it, because it was cut, part of it is what they call dog hair, you know, extremely thick, and a lot of those trees, those little trees, have over the past 15 years died, and they're maybe 2 to 3 inches in diameter. And I understand when you have a big tree, like there's a big Doug fir that got killed by bears, oh, maybe 10 years ago. And it's been really fun to watch it bleach. And I can't wait to start seeing some cavities in it. But who would eat, what good, I hate saying that that way, but what good are the 2-inch, who uses the dead dog hair trees when they die and then they're still standing up in the air? Does anybody use those, or are they too small to use? Is that insects use them?
I'm sure insects do, yes. Since we're quoting different people here, I'll quote Aldo Leopold or paraphrase him, and he said something to the point of about ignorance is the person who says, of what good is it? And I just naturally assume, and I know you do too, that there is some good in it, and I may not know what it is and may not be able to articulate it, and possibly because people never think to ask the question. And that is what I see more than anything is, I go out with these foresters on field trips, and I just see they never ask questions. An example would be, I was on a field trip not too long ago where the foresters were saying, well, there's this pathogen that's killing the root disease, and it's killing some of these Douglas fir. So we have to log the Douglas fir so that they won't die from this root disease. And the very first thing I said to these guys, I said, well, what good, what does the root disease do for the forest ecosystem? They didn't have an answer. It was a question that never occurred to them. And I didn't have an answer either, but at least the question occurred to me to ask, and that is, there must be some uncertain fungi, insects, bacteria, whatever, that depend on those dying roots from that root disease, and the trees that are die from that will serve some purpose in the ecosystem. And the idea that we need to remove them, again, it's the industrial paradigm. If your goal is to produce lumber for the sawmill, you don't probably want trees dying from root disease. But in terms of the forest ecosystem, that may be a very critical foundation for the ecosystem's overall resilience.
One of my favorite posters I saw, and I'm going to totally butcher this, but basically the poster was a picture of a Doug fir, quote, forest in Oregon, I believe, and the caption was something like, was comparing this, it was basically, this is as biodiverse as a cornfield in Iowa. And so it's the recognition that we have, and we recognize that if you have a cornfield in Iowa, that the people growing the corn are waging war against succession, waging war against the natural world, against the insects, against everybody who is impeding profit. But sometimes I think that it's easier to see it in a cornfield than it might be in a Doug fir plantation, which still we can go, gosh, this looks like a forest.
Yep. Well, exactly. The diversity in natural systems is much greater than agricultural systems. And, you know, think of the cornfield where we're trying to funnel as much solar energy into the corn plant to the exclusion of all other plants and therefore life, including insects that might want to feed upon the corn. And so That goal, the agricultural model, is the same thing applied to forest plantations and indirectly to the whole idea behind thinning and other manipulations of the forest. In every case, it's simplifying the ecosystem. You know, one way to visualize this is the contrast is, you know, a plantation or a cornfield is like a cement canal, and calling that a river. An irrigation canal with water flowing in it. It's all flowing all together in one cement tunnel, so to speak, for the water compared to, say, a river that's braided and has multiple channels and meanders back and forth. So there are many, many ways for that water to move and sustain all sorts of other plants and animals along the way. So what we try to do is turn our forests into basically irrigation canals to move as an irrigation canal to move water as rapidly as possible to specific places. To the paradigm applied to forests is to try to grow trees as rapidly as possible so that we can cut them down.
So what are, I mean, it seems to me that the fundamental paradigm, and we've said this explicitly in previous interviews, that the fundamental way that you and I both perceive the forest is that if there is something happening in the forest, the chances are really good that the forest knows what it's doing. And the forest knows better than we do what the forest needs.
Exactly. And that, to me, you know, the fundamental problem here for humanity is our arrogance. We don't have enough humility to ask again, what are we doing and how are we affecting things? We tend to think that we know what's best for the forest ecosystem. And the irony for me is that over and over again, even when I go out with foresters and others who think they know the best, is, you know, they'll be the first to admit that, oh, well, we used to think that it was a good thing to do this or that, 100 years ago or 50 years ago. We know better now. But it never seems to cause them to have doubt about what they know so much about today, that what they think is the correct management paradigm for today may be just as wrong for the forest as it was whatever was the paradigm from 100 years ago. Say the German forests of that Gifford Pinchot saw, where they would go through the forest and pick up every stick that fell to the ground, and you had this super sanitized forest, which today we recognize is really a bad thing in terms of the forest ecosystem, but that was the paradigm of 100 years ago, and foresters will admit that was terrible, but they don't seem to see that they have the same lack of sort of tunnel vision, half tunnel vision, and lack of humility towards how they're affecting the forest today.
So given that you and I agree that forests know better than we do what they need, and let's pretend that we can get rid of this culture's hatred of nature and attempts to control nature, and let's pretend we can get rid of the profit motive, okay? Mm-hmm. So if we go with all those, and given global warming, are there ways that you would want to, if they made you like the king of all things forestry, I mean, mm-hmm. I would want to just keep my hands off in general, but are there ways that you would want to intervene? Are there circumstances in which intervening is appropriate on an industrial scale?
Well, the only thing, and I say this with hesitation because
I understand.
I really would want to think it through, the consequences. But when there is some sort of exotic invasion sort of thing, in other words, what I mean by that is not the expansion of native trees or something into places where they previously weren't reported or thought not to exist, but more something like, Dutch elm disease or something like that, that is a disease or pathogen that is not native to the forest ecosystems. And if that could be controlled without jeopardizing other aspects of the forest ecosystem, I might be supportive of that kind of intervention. But again, I want to ask, what are the consequences of the intervention? A lot of times what I find is that the cure is worse than the disease in many of these instances. So, I would want to proceed with a lot of caution and a lot of questions.
I love that answer. And I think, a lot of people have said, oh gosh, Indians affected forests too, et cetera, et cetera. But the big difference is that if you've been living in place for the last 1,000 years or 10,000 years, and you're planning on living in place for the next 10,000 years, your land use decisions will be different. And so I love the idea of if you are going to intervene on some fairly large scale, of doing extensive thought experiments, recognizing nature is more complex than we can think, but doing, what could be the possible effects of doing it, and running the models in your head until you've caught up with the fact that a fire now is going to feed grizzly bears in 60 years. And just thinking so far into the future and caring for the future, really. I think caring for the future is more important than thinking into the future, really.
Well, that's right. And one of the things that, again, using the caution about this, you would want to ask yourself, is this something on a landscape scale? Is this, in other words, some sort of intervention? Is it going to really have a long-term effect in terms of the goal of reducing whatever it is that's, the impact to the forest? And can you see, you don't want to be having to control things forever. Some cases it may be that, you have to accept these invasions. The bad thing about today with our globalization and so forth is that we have ornamental trees and domestic trees being, or even lumber from other parts of the world being imported constantly, which is a source of for these exotic diseases and insects and so forth to get established in the country. And a lot of the stuff that we're having to deal with today, like the green ash borer that's working across the United States killing ash trees, or whether it was the Dutch elm disease, et cetera, a lot of those were introduced inadvertently by importing trees and shrubs from outside of the country. And, this whole mixing of plants and animals, particularly domesticated ornamental stuff that people put in their yards, is often the source of a lot of this introduction. And we certainly don't seem to do enough about trying to prevent that from happening.
So I completely agree. And I'm going to go back to what you said about dead trees. And we've got about 7 or 8 minutes left. And before we talk more about dead trees, I want to ask you something else I've been thinking about dead beings, which is, I worry a lot about how forests will continue generically, given how much wildlife has crashed. I know that when salmon return to salmon forests, the trees grow some ridiculous amount, like 70% faster. It's a huge amount. And
right.
I think about this, where I live in Northern California, prior to conquest, well, there were salmon, but there were also, for example, if you were by a river, you'd see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes. And how are forests, and with songbird populations collapsing, everything, all this biomass disappearing, how are forests going to survive not just the lack of dead trees, but how do they survive the lack of poop? And how do they survive the lack of dead animals? Because everybody eats everybody. And isn't this a tremendous amount of animal biomass that is also has been removed from forests, or is that not as important as the woody biomass?
Well, I would never say it's not as important. I just don't know how to answer your question because I do know of examples, for example, that you mentioned, how bears eating salmon along a stream and then pooping, 100, 200 yards from the stream, adds nutrients far from the stream bank to a forest ecosystem. And, or bears eating berries and then depositing, or birds eating berries and depositing them elsewhere, and how important things like that are for the health of the forest. And since we've reduced bears and we've reduced some, in some cases, certain bird species, what effect is that having in the long term? I just can't say, but we can certainly suggest that it can't be good in the long run. So I think your concern are legitimate. I just don't have the answer to say, how it's going to affect things.
So before we finish up, I guess I have another question too about dead beings who are not trees. And another thing I see in a lot of these like a clear cut, there's also a lot of removal of shrubbery. And do you want to talk for a minute about the effects? You talked about the other effects of logging on areas, and one of the effects certainly is to get rid of some of the undergrowth. And can you talk for just a minute about the importance of undergrowth for many types of forests?
Oh yeah, and that's what I'm glad you brought that up, because I see all the time all these thinning operations. Besides just taking out the trees, a lot of times they take machines in there and crush and cut up the brush underneath the forest, and they just start making these things into sanitized stands. And those shrubs, again, for example, I was out with the Forest Service this fall in California there, and they were saying they wanted to do herbicide to get rid of brush after a fire, ceanothus and other shrubs that tend to come in after fire. And those shrubs are very important for nitrogen fixing and add nitrogen to the soil, which ultimately helps to grow the forest. And they wanted to short-circuit that shrub layer because the shrubs persist for 20 or 30 years, and during that time, it's harder for the conifers to get reestablished. And so, again, trying to, hasten the growth of conifers, which the ultimate goal is to cut them down again, they are short-circuiting the whole ecological process. And in short-circuiting that, that has lots of other effects, because there's a lot of birds, for example, that only nest in shrubby habitat. There's insects that depend on those shrubs. I read one study, this is not shrubs, but just to give you an idea, I believe it was with aspen trees, but that they documented over 400 native insects that live on aspen trees. And, I may have it wrong, but the point being is that there are a lot of insects out there that are very specific to certain trees and shrubs. And so when we take them out, we take out those insects, and those insects play an important role for feeding birds, feeding reptiles and amphibians and so forth on up through the food chain. So, thinking that shrubs are bad is the way that a lot of the industrial paradigm looks at it. And so we need to get rid of it. And, you go in these thin forests around where I'm living here in Oregon, they're just sterilized. They're just trees and all the shrubs. They've gone in with a masticator and cut down and torn up, and they've taken out all the snags, and there's no dead wood on the ground, and they call that forest resilience, and I call it an ecological disaster zone.
And I'm thinking of a line by E.O. Wilson, where, once again, I'm going to butcher this, but basically, if humans disappeared, the Earth would go on fine, but if beetles disappeared, the Earth would collapse immediately.
Right.
And in terms, so if you get rid of all the shrubbery, which has all sorts of insects, I mean, who knows what sort of effects that'll have?
Here's an example of the interrelationships. This is not with shrubs per se, but ants I mentioned earlier, for example. There are any number of flower species out there that depend on ants to move their seeds around and bury the seeds in trilliums one, if you know the flower trilliums.
I love trillium. They're blooming right now.
Trillium in the forest are dependent on ants to move the seeds around. You know, so if you get rid of the down wood and you don't have the ants anymore, you don't have trillium anymore. So, those are the kind of relationships that, I go out with the foresters and I ask them to tell me what's going on, and I will say, what ants are here? And, of course, I don't know the answer, but they don't either. They don't even think about the ants. So that's the problem.
So we have, like, a minute left, and if you could have people take away one thing that they know in their heart, well, two questions, actually. First one is, are there any questions you wanted me to ask about dead trees that I haven't? Is there anything you want to say that I haven't given you opportunity to say about dead trees?
What I would say, sort of in summary, is that don't assume that dead trees are bad for forest ecosystems. In fact, for a lot of species out there, they live in mortal fear of green forests because they're so dependent on dead trees. And a lot of species are dead tree obligates. In other words, they can't live in a forest unless there's dead trees. So the whole idea that a healthy forest is a green forest is a total, needs a total paradigm shift to incorporate the idea that we need a lot of dead wood in the forest, and dead wood is what creates resilient forest ecosystems.
Well, thank you so much for your just decades of incredibly important work, and thank you for being on the program. I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.